I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Avila Beach, California.
My name is Sasha Vasiliuk, and I'm the author of the novel Your Presence is Mandatory.
And that's built around your grandfather, your real grandfather, right?
It is, yes. It was inspired by a letter that we discovered a few weeks after he died. He was a World War II vet in Ukraine. He was
in
Jewish.
In the Russian army.
In the Soviet army, working for Mr. Stalin, defending Soviet Union against the Nazis. And what he never talked about World War II, as I think many veterans tend not to. There was an assumption that he sort of created that he was a war hero, a decorated war hero. And that's the assumption we operated under his whole life. Then the guy passes away, and a few weeks later we found a letter that he'd left that he had written addressed to the KGB.
Oh, that's the one. In the 80s. Wow, where it's kind of a confessional.
Correct. Apparently at some point the KGB discovered discrepancies in his war record and asked what the heck. So he had to explain himself, and this is the letter we find. The letter was written in the 80s. We find it 30 years later. Grandpa is dead. We can't really ask him any questions about it. But that was the seed for the novel.
Well, I've been reading your book for the last 2 days, and that's literally where I had to put it down to come see you. He's with the KGB, and he hands him the letter, and that's my cliffhanger.
All right.
What happened?
Yeah, I don't want to spoil it for you. The dilemma that I was interested in discovering was, why did my grandpa feel like he had to hide what happened to him
from his family?
From his family, yeah. And from the government. How he was able to do it, because this is a totalitarian regime, it's not that easy to hide things. And also, why did he, after confessing to the KGB, after the Soviet Union falls apart, he continued to hide this from his family?
Wow. He told the KGB, that was what he was hoping, right? Is that they would not snitch him off.
Correct, yes.
So they did not?
They did not. So I wanted to kind of play with this idea of the government versus a person versus a family that is clueless about who this person really is and what their past is, and how big of a role fear and shame play in a society like that and in a person's mind like that.
Well, there's those layers too, because you mentioned this in the book, in that if you had to surrender and you became a prisoner of war, there was a shame associated with that.
Correct. Yes, this is something that is typically very shocking for Western readers because POWs are treated rather well. However, in Soviet Union, POWs was pretty much the same as being a traitor. It meant that you hung out with the enemy, even if you were in camps, doesn't matter. You were still exposed to the enemy. That means you were no longer, you were potentially corrupted. And so there was always this doubt cast upon you, like basically for the rest of your life.
And your grandfather wound up having to be a slave labor worker in Nazi Germany.
Correct.
A prisoner.
Yes. So there was there were about several million POWs. There were also several million people, civilians, who were carted off to Germany, and they became forced laborers. A lot of them came from Ukraine, some from Belarus, Russia as well. A lot of them were women, and a lot of them were children, like up to 10-year-olds who were there. And this is a very little-known aspect of World War II, which is interesting because World War II is like the most studied event, you know, probably of the 20th century. And yet there remain these gaps of history that I also didn't know about. They're not talked about in Eastern Europe either, partly because it's sort of considered very shameful. So none of the people who survived both of these things ever really talked about them to their families.
And then on another level, again, you allude to it literally in the Ukraine in World War II, the basically the traitors that were Ukrainians that allied with the Nazis and snitched off Ukrainian neighbors and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, war is complicated, and there was some of that. That wasn't as interesting to me, although it is historically accurate that some Ukrainians, and there were some legions that worked with the Nazis. There was also a Russian general who kind of defected and started an army.
Oh, that was Vlasov?
Vlasov, yes.
Wow,
isn't as politically hot these days. He was a general who wanted to liberate Russia from Stalin, and the only way he thought to do that was to align himself with the Nazis.
And so they helped feed him fodder of imprison Russian prisoners of war to join his army.
Correct. He recruited heavily. He wrote all these pamphlets that try to convince, you know, the Russians who were already in Germany to rise up against Stalin and sort of revert course and go back and defeat him. Very complicated history of a lot of people moving back and forth.
Reading your book, one, just how you captured, like, your grandfather being an artilleryman and being in the trenches and operating the cannon and whatnot. You would have thought you were some guy writer, you know, I mean, you just nailed that war dynamic of being an artilleryman. So you must have done a lot of research about that topic.
Thank you, Tom. This is literally the best compliment.
Really? I thought I might embarrass you.
No, this was my probably biggest fear. I'm a girl. I've never been to a war zone. I've never shot a gun. Even the word artillery, I had to like look it up and understand what the heck, like how it works. Yeah. It's also, this is 70 years ago. I did not want to write this novel for very long. Once I discovered the letter, I thought there was a novel there, but it took me 10 more years to actually touch it because I was like, who am I to write a World War II novel about some soldier? And I think what changed, what kind of made me finally do it, was the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict in 2014. It came, it sort of originated in the separatist kind of movement, originated basically right in front of my grandparents' apartment in a city called Donetsk. I spent every summer there my whole life, even when I lived in America. So I knew the place well, and seeing war there was incredibly shocking. So I actually went there.
So when you were there, it was peaceful, and it was a sweet city.
It was, yeah. It was a peaceful city of 1 million people, so a pretty big city for American standards. And then all of a sudden, this war breaks out. My family still lives there. My grandma, who'd survived World War II, is now facing a second war in her life, when she's 90. Became kind of safe, and I'm using quotes here. I went to visit, and what I saw was a very, very tiny glimpse of what war feels like. I wasn't in the field shooting anything, but I heard shelling. When I was walking late at night, I saw what a city becomes when it's occupied, and I felt the fear. And I think that feeling, that fear, gave me the confidence of, I'm like, you know what? Maybe I can write a book about war.
So you were born in Crimea, and then you moved to Ukraine, right?
So Crimea is in Ukraine, depending on people's interpretation of events. But yes, I was born in Crimea, and I lived there until I was six, and then we moved to Moscow.
Oh, really?
I spent another 6 years there, and then we moved to the States.
Yeah. So you did not live in Kiev?
No, I never lived in Kiev, but my dad's side of the family is Ukrainian and Jewish-Ukrainian, so they were all in Ukraine, and I was literally there every summer.
Oh, wow. And so he was working for the government in Moscow then, your father?
No, I don't have anybody who worked for the government. No, my parents were psychologists, and they were in Crimea working at a mental institution next to which I was born.
Wow.
And then when they were young psychologists, and then they wanted to move back to kind of the big city and do some stuff there.
Back to your 90-year-old grandma you were talking about? Earlier you were talking about a 90-year-old.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you made me remember my time in Estonia right after the coup. And I was with these women that had a chorale group that started in the 1930s when they were young girls. So they are teenagers when it's the Estonian Republic. And then the Russians come in, it's taken over. And then the Germans come in, they take over.
Yep.
And at the end of World War II, they're going, oh, free at last. Nope, Russians come back in. So at the end of their lives, when I met them, they wake up one day and it's the Estonian Republic again. So there must be some parallel shades in the Ukraine.
Absolutely. Yeah. So my family, my grandma's seen all kinds of things. And this eastern part of Ukraine, that was kind of Putin's, I don't know, reason for entering Ukraine under this false, bogus idea of like, we're going to rescue Russian speakers from Ukrainian Nazis, all of which is completely ridiculous and made up. He was referring to this eastern part where my family lived and where, yes, they did tend to speak Russian, although they were born speaking Ukrainian.
Was that partly the political power structure of the Russians dominating in Ukraine? that momentum to learn Russian and speak Russian?
I mean, yeah, I think Soviet Union's project was to unify all of these very, very different people from, mm-hmm. you know, 11 time zones or however many there were, who came from different religions and, very different histories. You know, you take any of like Central Asian republics and you combine them with Estonia. They don't have that much in common, to be honest, right? Yeah. But you have to kind of rule them all. And so one of the easiest and most important things is, of course, language. You give them the same language. And so Russian was very dominant. If you look at anyone from there, they're typically grandparents were born speaking one language. Mm-hmm. By the time it was the next generation, so like my parents' generation or mine, that was gone. They were usually either not learning it at all or learning it at school, but it was very, you know, learn a foreign language at school, you're not really going to speak it super well, typically. And then by the time it came to my generation, I was born in the 80s, any remnants of any other language were gone. I don't speak Ukrainian.
Any Russian? You still speak Russian?
I still speak Russian, mm-hmm. Yes, and that came very handy because I don't think this book would have been possible to write if I didn't.
Really? How did it help you the most?
All of my research was basically primary sources and books that are not translated, that were very hard to find, mm-hmm. because POWs, as I said earlier, and the forced laborers didn't really write about their experience or talk about it. But there were some historians that I found eventually. It took a while. But all of their material is in Russian. So there's no way to write this book without that.
Another dynamic about you that fascinated me was your deft ability to have this broad watercolor brush to paint what it was like in these towns, both in Germany and in the Ukraine. You gave it this universality too. And I know it resonated with you because you've been in so many ways, people are so much alike in Kiev, for example, versus San Francisco. Not that unlike, you know, celebrating birthday parties or going to the park that you talk about in the book, and just these human basic elements. I think you did a masterful job of doing a visual brushstrokes of bringing that to life.
Thank you. It helped that I spent a year in Germany. I gave birth to my son in Germany, actually. So I saw all kinds of parts that, you know, if you're just visiting, you're not going to see, like a labor hospital. And I did want to give humanity, like really deep kind of humanity to everybody in this book, no matter which side of things they were on.
And that's another thing that fascinated me. I spent time in Germany too. And you did a great job of that, you know, non-Nazi fanatic, the farmer in a rural town, and how life was so similar to other countries. It wasn't that unlike.
Yes, I didn't want to make a book about, like, here are the bad Nazis and here are the good Soviets. I mean, unfortunately, I think that is the rhetoric that, like, Putin uses to this day. And it isn't that simple, you know? Like, life isn't black and white. There's complicated emotions and things change. One thing that I learned that was interesting was how kind of much the Germans changed as the war changed against them, you know? Like, all of a sudden they could see that they weren't favored to win it, and fear crept in. And fear is a powerful emotion, right? It's really going to change how you treat people around you, how you treat your employees or enemies.
So they were humbled in a communal sense. Yeah.
Yes, humbled, afraid, and embarrassed. All kinds of very complex emotions that I wanted to put in there.
That's really fascinating. And so part of your story is your imagination, kind of reading in from your baseline of having lived in Ukraine and having spent time in Germany. But then you take it and you paint this fictional story that's based on historical fact. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, I was trained as a journalist, and this is my first kind of big work of fiction. But I did use a lot of research and interviews and kind of journalistic techniques that, you know, that were taught in journalism school. But yes, it was really fun to fictionalize events. I don't think there was a way to write this book, even though it is based on my grandfather and my family. That was really the seed. You know, that's like 10% of it. Really 90% of it had to be made up.
Like you said, familial primary source was negligible.
Yes.
It basically was his confessional
letter. Yes, it's a two-page letter addressed to the KGB. So as you can imagine, it did not have a lot of emotions, or the facts could have been very much not true for all I know, right?
And then there was that moment where his daughter, I think it was, asked him to come to school and talk about his war experience. And he finally did. Talk to us about that interlude.
Sure. So he has two kids, a daughter and a son. And at some point, the daughter, it's there's going to be celebration of Victory Day, of like 20th anniversary of Victory Day. And her teacher asks her to bring her dad that she'd heard is this war hero who made it to Berlin. And this is a guy full of valor and bravery. Why don't you bring him to school to tell us all about what he did during the war? And here comes this guy who never talks about the war and who has something very big to hide. And he's now forced to basically stand in front of kids and say something, you know, but it can't be a total lie. It kind of has to be, this, it has to feel like it's true. And so what I had him do is deliver kind of a mixed where he's using some things that we as a reader know really happened. And then you can see him veering off and making stuff up kind of on the fly and using a lot of these like propagandistic, very Soviet sentences. And the daughter is listening and she sometimes she believes him. And then she's like, no, my dad doesn't talk like this. That doesn't sound right. I think he's lying. And she's like, wait, no, but he never lies. He wouldn't be lying to this class. And so we see kind of how secrecy operates and how when somebody's forced to lie in front of a large group of people, how they manage to maneuver around it.
And another fascinating aside was your time talking about inside of the German prisoner of war camp, specifically segregated for Russian prisoners, and how they treated the Russians was brutal compared to how they treated the American pilots and whatnot in their prison camps.
Yes, this was a huge eye-opener for me. So when I discovered my grandpa's letter, there was a lot I didn't know about the war. I felt like I kind of knew things, you know, as we all knew, we've seen movies. But what I didn't know is about the POW treatment of Soviet POWs and how, yes, they were often segregated and put in camps kind of right next to camps so they could see the European POWs right next to them.
And
they
had soccer and rugby.
Playing soccer and like having a decent time. The Red Cross would come to visit and deliver food for them. They had blankets, they had electricity, all of these things. And none of which they had. And there's a lot of now kind of research about this, but Germans really were purposefully exterminating Soviet POWs. This wasn't incidental that they were just like separating the two and, you know, didn't have enough money to feed the Soviets or anything. No, no, no. They wanted them dead. And so there were about, I think, 5.7 captured total and more than half of them, so 3.2 million were killed.
Wow. Or starved to death. Or
Yeah, killed in various ways, sometimes shot directly and sometimes just starved to death, you know, tons of diseases. But yeah.
Amazing. And what is the total number of Russian dead in World War II? Close to 20 million?
I believe it's 27 million of Soviet citizens. There's a fascinating graph that I found at some point that breaks down kind of the percentage by country. So like Belarus, I think it's Belarus, 25% of Belarusians died in World War II.
Wow.
Like it is just the numbers are staggering.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, it is writing this book, I was writing it obviously for an American audience, for a Western audience, for Europeans. And it's interesting to kind of feel the difference in how much war is still present for Europeans versus how kind of it isn't as much here. I went to World War II Museum in New Orleans last year. There was barely a mention, this is like Tom Hanks' project, there was barely a mention of Soviet Union at all. It's
wow.
like, they, but you know, a decent part of it is dedicated to the European theater. Yeah. And if you come out and if you know nothing else, what you would think is like, Americans did it all. They saved the day
and
they captured everything. But no, you know, there's a whole other side to the story.
In Moscow, did you go to any war museums there?
You know, I did not. And I believe that there are some that have been added recently. Mm-hmm. But this is a complicated subject because Putin is really using the memory of World War II to...
propaganda.
As propaganda and to kind of excuse some of the things that he's doing. There's now laws. So, for example, this book, Your Presence is Mandatory, will not be published in Russia because it breaks several laws that Putin made up, some of them very recent, in the way he seems to be very paranoid in the way World War II history is described today. And so I wouldn't be allowed to be there with this book.
Wow. So maybe you're not going to be able to go back to Moscow.
Oh, I certainly can't go back to Moscow. I've done some journalism on this war, on the war in Ukraine, because as I said, my family has been involved. A lot of them became refugees from both Ukraine and Russia. And yeah, I've written articles for New York Times and other big publications, and I'm not officially on any blacklist because there's a blacklist.
But they'd be looking for you if you showed up.
But yes, yeah. I have. There's no way I can.
We'd be reading about you in the Washington Post. Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be me and Evan Gershkovich.
Yeah. Pretty brutal. So the book, is this your first nonfiction book you've written?
This is my first novel. Yes.
And was it scary? And were you questioning the journey as you're putting it together?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm like, for a long time, I also was worried, not just about my ability to, like, as a journalist, to write fiction. That mm-hmm. was part of the worry. Second worry, as I said, was what's a girl doing writing, you know, about a, right, a male exactly. soldier from a war from 70 years ago. But a third was, will American readers want to read about Soviet Union and stuff? And this isn't fully a World War II novel. You know, half of it takes place in World War II, but the other half takes place in Ukraine and Soviet Union from World War II until this current war.
Well, I think the greater lens, it's a story of the human condition. It's beyond politics. It's beyond borders. It really is.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that was the goal. I wanted mm-hmm. it to be appealing. I wanted it to be a page-turner, but sort of even though you're reading about a different time and a different place and about a country that no longer exists, you're still relating to the people in the story.
That's really interesting. So you got a publisher.
I got a publisher. I got a wonderful publisher in the U.S. It's being published by Bloomsbury, and they've been amazing. And then it's coming out in Italy, France, Germany, Finland, wow. and Brazil with different publishers there.
All different translations.
Correct, yeah.
Wow.
Which I will not be able to read, but I do speak Italian, so at least I'll read that one.
So I get to say I knew Sasha when. Hopefully you'll still answer my call.
Anytime, Tom.
That's so cool. A little bit more about what's closest to your heart, what you feel proudest about in this whole process of writing the book and telling the story.
You know, I was working on the story for several years, and while there was a regional war in Ukraine, I was working on the last chapter, which actually takes place like in the current time, when Putin announced the invasion of Ukraine. And all of a sudden, the book that I've been writing for several years acquired this new sinister significance. And I've been watching kind of my family suffer from this, and all of these millions of people, refugees all over Europe and US. And so now this book kind of acquired a mission that it didn't have as much before.
How long has this process been going on?
I started it actually when I moved to Berlin, 7 months pregnant. I started in 2017. So yeah, it took about 4.5 years. And then all of a sudden there was a full on war and everybody was making parallels to World War II because mm-hmm. this was a big... So yeah, it's very strange to have written a book that now felt timely.
Devil's advocate for a moment today in Russia. I know a couple of people. I know one woman that lives on the Central Coast that's very proud of Putin.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Yes.
Have you met that ilk?
I am very lucky that nobody in my family is of that guilt, but almost everybody I know in the Russian-speaking community here, so all the immigrants, almost everybody I know has somebody in their family, typically a parent, sometimes a sister, yeah, who's on the other side of politics.
Why are they supporters of Putin? Why do they think he's cool?
It's interesting when supporters of Putin are people who are immigrants who obviously don't want to live in Russia, right? Mm-hmm. And yet they support it. So I think it's easier in a way to maybe support a dictator when you don't live under his watchful eye. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason is that Russian television actually operates very actively in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's very easy. There's lots of channels. They're very cheap, and everybody basically watches them. So, yes, that propaganda seeps through and has kind of very similar effect that it has on the people there.
It's really interesting. I'm friends with for people from Iran who are immigrants to America. And at some point or another, they confess that they are staunch Trump supporters mm-hmm. as immigrants. And mm-hmm. I went, wow. Objectively, I would have thought they would have learned this lesson from Iran, but not so. Somehow, that kind of Putonian way resonates with immigrants.
Yes. Yes. That's the same thing with the Soviet immigrants. A ton of them, probably majority. I mean, I'm not sure I'll get right because there's no stats, but a ton of them, especially of a certain age, like of my parents' age, 60s, 70s, are mm-hmm. definitely pro-Trump. I don't know how they're going to vote this year. I don't know if they like, you know, no longer feel as strongly about him as mm-hmm. they did the first time. But yes, he was huge with the immigrants.
Interesting. So there's some comfort without having to think too much.
I think partly is like, at least I can speak for Soviet Soviet immigrants, they are very afraid of anything that's too hard on the left because mm-hmm. communism is a very leftist movement. And so when they see that, they immediately just kind of pivot.
Veer
to the right. Yeah. And here comes Trump. And they're not thinking of him as like, oh, he's similar to a dictator. That's not, you know, mm-hmm. they just feel that he's defending certain values on a right that they feel safer operating with.
How cool. We could go on forever, but I'm going to let you go. We're in Avila Beach, California, and you're on holiday, right?
That's right. Yeah, so, I came here with my family.
So you've taken time out of your playing on the beach to meet with me, and I really appreciate that a lot.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank you for driving down and for reading my novel.
Oh, yeah, easy. Come to Avila. I mean, that's real tough one.
Yeah, it's beautiful here.
To learn more about Sasha's world, where would you take us?
My book is called Your Presence is Mandatory. It's sold anywhere books are sold. Please support your indie bookstore. And you can find me on all kinds of social media that I should probably stop using. But for now, I'm using it. Sasha Vasilyuk. And my website Vasilyuk. Yeah, I hope you guys pick up the book. It comes out April 23rd. I'm excited to launch this nerve-wracked as well.
That's exciting. Are there any photos in it? I'm reading the online download. Are there photos in there?
There are not photos, but on Instagram, every week I put up historical photos that explain different parts of the book.
And a photo of your grandfather?
Yeah, I've posted a photo of my grandfather a few times. Him young as a soldier and then him older as well.
Sasha, thanks again. This is great.
Thanks so much, Tom. Appreciate it.
And I'm so glad I got to read your book and I got to go home and finish it.
Yay. All right. Let me know what you think of the end.
Yeah. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Avila Beach, California.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
World Bicycle Relief partners with communities to deliver specially designed, locally assembled rugged bicycles for people in need. Nearly 1 billion people in rural regions of the world live in communities far from the nearest paved road, walking miles every day just to survive. Distance is a barrier to attending school, receiving health care, delivering goods to market, and other critical services needed to thrive. Find out how you can help deliver rugged, dependable, life-changing bicycles to deserving communities. Log on to worldbicyclerelief.org to learn more. Yeah.
Jesus, come, my dear.